You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 20th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Duss on the Iran deal. Also on the program today, we catch up from our week back. From our week backs. And our return from vacation. Matt, now a daddy.
That's true. That's very true.
We will catch up with that. I mean, people know it was a boy. It was a boy. Still a boy.
Still is.
Okay. We'll announce the name. I mean, you announced it on Twitter, but we'll announce it verbally for the first time. Also on the program today, Obama's incarceration reform agenda. He visits a prison, for what it's worth. We'll find out. Also, Bernie Sanders, big crowds in Phoenix and in Dallas, huge crowds, but also a weakness revealed. Bit of a flaw, mishandling, in my estimation, of protests at Netroots Nation by, I guess you could call the aggregate groups of Black Lives Matter. Also on the program today, Jade Helm, Day 5. And coincidentally or not, the day that we open a embassy and an embassy opens here, a Cuban embassy, and ours in Cuba, an American embassy in Cuba. Also, coincident or not, Jade Helm, Day 5, Michael Grimm sentenced to prison. All a little too comfortable. Meanwhile, the clown car continues to rumble on. Scott Walker up a little bit in the polls, I guess presumably because he's doing more poor shaming. Rubio still around, but Trump under siege by the establishment. I got plenty to say about that. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We are back from vacation. And Matt will now pull down the sound. It's been a while. He's a little bit rusty. So let's get to what's really important here. We have a couple of minutes before we invite Matt Duss on the program, who is, of course, the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, and will talk to us about this really, I think, pretty extraordinary and historical agreement that we have with Iran. But first, Matt, get on the microphone, please. Tell us what happened. Apparently you have a child now.
I do.
How did that happen?
Well, do you need me to explain?
I mean, there was a lot of people who really thought that... Yeah, that's enough, folks. You were faking it, that you weren't actually, that nobody really anticipated that you could actually have a child. I don't know why, or that
baby
you would.
Baby Gate Ghazi.
That's right. There was a lot of...
rumors?
I mean, a lot of the men's rights advocates said that they didn't believe it, that this was just a way for you to try and...
Well, believe it, suckers.
Beef up, like make you look more... Like if you were a dad, that you'd come across as more masculine in some fashion. And so there was a big theory out there that you were staging this whole thing.
Let's put it this way, I won't be winning Mangina of this year.
I guess not. Well, there you go.
The losers.
So what is
Did
the
you
name?
See that Trump came out right there.
What is the name of your child?
His name is Ezra Oliver Otoya Binder.
There you go.
That's his full name.
That's his full name.
We actually had a
Ezra
great,
Binder.
We had a great moment because you were traveling. But on Thursday's show, Matt texted me during the fun half, and I was able to give like a play-by-play because the baby had just arrived.
Not really a play-by-play.
Play-by-play, no. The baby was born at 11:15, right?
11:43 a.m.
Well, I had no idea. I didn't know until
July 9th.
Was it 11:43 a.m.?
Yeah, so I was able to text Michael.
I thought it was 11:23.
And he was able to just... Give a little update of him being
name.
Born. There was no play-by-play.
And just how long, when did you go to the hospital? Let's put it that way. I don't want to get too many personal
details.
Well,
we went on Tuesday.
Right.
Previous Tuesday was July 7th.
Right.
And then they sent us back home, and it was just...
Part of your false flag operation.
Yes, of course.
And then?
There was just a waiting game, and then at around 1:15 a.m. on July 9th, we went to the hospital.
There you go. And so he was born about, 10 hours later?
Yeah.
All right. That's not too bad. Apparently, your baby is sleeping. Is that correct?
He's a good baby. The first night, he wasn't a good baby, but he's since, you know, I told him.
The amount of resent that I feel is really quite, it's amazing. The idea that you're talking about one night of no sleep.
Well, I mean, he does wake up during the night, but he's not horrible.
You said you have to wake him to feed him. And
does,
when I hear stories
happen,
like
yes.
that, that is just obscene.
That does happen, yes.
It's disgusting. It's disgusting. Well,
he likes sitting in rockers and stuff. Those things make him sleep.
Oh, yeah.
If he's flat, like in his bassinet, it's not the same.
All right. Well, I can only hope that you're going to have, a lot of trouble getting him to sleep in the future coming months or years.
He's a good kid. He's got a good Robert De Niro face.
Milo did not sleep for the first 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
6 years with no sleep.
Well, she just wasn't sleeping. She didn't go to sleep easily.
He's superhuman.
We're going to talk about, obviously, over the course of, we will talk more about Matt's baby and start to mock Matt's baby. We're going to bring him in, make fun of him, and taunt the baby. As we go on. But just to catch up, obviously, we're going to talk a lot about this over the course of the next coming days. Greece, for all intents and purposes, I guess, I'm a little bit lost what's happened over the past 48 hours. But Greece was basically given a deal, I'm putting that in quotes, that was harsher, and it remains in my mind to be seen what's going to happen. There's obviously protests in Greece. You can provide more loans, but if you have continued austerity, you're just digging a deeper hole in terms of debt. And I don't think any of this is frankly resolved in any way. We'll also talk about these protests at Netroots Nation, the drama. I mean, I wasn't there. I missed it this year, and the fallout from it. I think people are making a little bit more than is necessary. Frankly, some people seem to be overwrought by the whole thing. I mean, and here's my I don't know if we have time to get into it. We will talk about this later in the program as well, because I think at the end of the day, if you are supporter of Bernie Sanders, this is actually, in my estimation, a positive for you. And as I am. And if you are a supporter of the message that I think is being communicated by Black Lives Matter protesters, I think this is also a positive. There's a lot of good things that came out of this, and frankly, I don't think there were any negatives. I hear some people say that they think, well, now there's not going to be any presidential candidates that come to Netroots Nation. BS. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. There will always be candidates. If they're going to go, they're going to go. I mean, Hillary Clinton didn't go this time because she's up by 40 points. If there's a race where you've got three people who are tied at 25 and two other candidates, they're going to go. So all of that hand-wringing, I think, is completely unnecessary and silly. And silly. We'll also talk about, and we should note that obviously this protest that took place, I guess Saturday now, came just days after another story of a alleged suicide of an African-American woman who was en route to a job interview. Out-of-state job interview, and was pulled over on a traffic violation, supposedly got difficult, was put in jail for a couple of days, and then found that she had committed suicide with a plastic bag. The whole thing sounds, but we will know more on that later. But of course, it's simply another story of just a freak accident or freak happening of a death of an African-American person, unarmed. We'll also talk about Cuba. I mean, to the extent that it's pretty amazing, we haven't had normalized relations with Cuba in, I think, almost since, well, my parents were alive, but certainly none of us here. It's been, what, 50 years? 54 years. And Michael Grimm goes to prison. So we've got good news as well as some neutral news. He should have a fun time in prison. We will get to all of this today and over the next couple of days. Good to be back. Great feedback on the shows when we were on vacation. If you haven't listened to those, go back and listen to those as well. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Duss. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Matt Duss, the president for the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
So, all right, let's start with your piece in the New Republic. Obviously, there's a lot of components to this deal. But you wrote in the New Republic, the Iran deal is a victory for Obama diplomacy over Bush warmongering. Just set that up for us as a way of entering into what this deal is and is not.
Sure. I think, you know, the context that I provide is that I'm saying we have to go back to 2008 when Senator Barack Obama was still running for president. There was a lot of anti-war feeling. People were hugely disenchanted with the Iraq War. And Barack Obama came, and there was a great line he had during one of the primary debates where they were discussing the Iraq War, and he clarified, he said, you know, I don't want to just end the Iraq War. I want to end the mindset that got us into the Iraq War. And I know a lot of other foreign policy analysts, especially progressive foreign policy analysts, were really inspired by that, because I think that really got at one of the problems. It wasn't just dealing with this particular military intervention. It was dealing with a whole mindset that sees military intervention and military force as the primary instrument through which the United States expresses its power in the world. So when he became president, he started immediately reaching out to Iran, trying to talk to Iran, bringing partners together. When the Iran talks didn't go anywhere, he moved to the pressure track, sanctions at the UN, sanctions unilaterally by the United States. And eventually, the Iranians came to the table, and we've achieved this deal. And I think it's a really important achievement for that, you know, trying to find a different way of advancing American security that doesn't rely on the military as the primary tool. Of course, the military is one of a number of tools the United States has. But, you know, this agreement shows that you can use diplomacy. You can sit down with your partners and your adversaries and actually advance American security very effectively.
All right, so let's back up just a little bit more, because when George Bush entered office, George W. Bush, the Iranians had very little, I guess, capacity to enrich uranium, right? And
right.
My understanding is that as of like 15 years ago or so, Iran had like barely two dozen centrifuges. And the Bush administration refused to deal with Iran in any, I guess, formal way to address Iran's desire to have a nuclear program. And that's not necessarily a nuclear weapon program, but in any way. So, I mean, just give us a sense of what the dynamic that was at play with that, and then where Iran's program was by the time that Obama became president.
Right. I mean, even in the middle of the George W. Bush administration, there was what's known as the EU3, that's Great Britain, France, and Germany, talking with Iran, trying to address its nuclear program. This is at a time when Iran had just a few hundred centrifuges. There was an opportunity there for the Bush administration to engage and address Iran's program when it was much, much smaller than it is today. The Bush administration, you know, we can go back to the infamous line from Dick Cheney saying we don't negotiate with evil, we defeat it. And that was the mindset that prevailed at that time. So having had an opportunity to get to an agreement when Iran had a few hundred centrifuges, the Bush administration held a very, very hard line, and any possibility of a deal fell apart. And now we fast forward to the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration, where Iran now has, around 20,000 centrifuges. So I think we can see, I mean, we have this opportunity to really see how these different theories of foreign policy work in action. The Bush administration, they made very stringent demands. Iran refused to meet those demands. The Bush administration continued to make very harsh speeches. And the end result was that Iran had a much, much bigger nuclear program.
Now, the assumption that we make when we compare the ineffectiveness of the Bush administration's, foreign policy in terms of what they choose to use versus the Obama's, the assumption is that they wanted to get to the same place, right? I mean, if the calculation is we want to curtail Iran's nuclear program, then the Bush administration clearly failed. I mean, clearly failed. But that presumes that's what the Bush administration wanted, right? There's a lot of reason to believe, at least for the better part of the Bush administration, there was at least a strong contingency in there saying Iran is next, maybe after Syria.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think even in Bush's more moderate second term, you still had, you know, a very hawkish faction led by the vice president himself, Dick Cheney, that was really had their eyes on Iran and thought at some point military force should be used and was sort of pushing for that. But I think the president himself, you know, with a number of more moderate advisors like National Security Advisor Steve Hadley and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, I think, you know, thankfully had a much more reasonable take on how, you know, how to go about this, even though it didn't really produce the outcomes they wanted. But I think there is a consensus between the two administrations that, yes, preventing an Iranian nuclear weapon is the goal, but they just differed on what tools to use to achieve that. I think it's also really important to note one other thing here. You know, you hear a lot of talk over the past few weeks about how this deal will strengthen Iran and the region. I mean, let's just understand. There's nothing in this deal that will come close to strengthening Iran as much as the U.S. invasion of Iraq did.
Right, of course. That changed the entire dynamic. It completely shifted the power of the balance of power. All right, but before we get to that, so the sanctions that are involved in this, these sanctions did not exist. As far as I understand it, in terms of American sanctions, there are actually sort of like multiple sanctioned regimes, right? So there's not just one set of sanctions. What sanctions were imposed because of this nuclear question? What sanctions are imposed for other reasons? Which ones are U.S., which ones are EU and the world, I guess, and which ones remain and are gone?
Well, I think you had several UN Security Council resolutions during the Bush administration, and then some in the Obama administration that froze the assets of certain Iranian members of their government because of their association with the nuclear program. But I think it wasn't, under the Obama administration as well, similar, you know, by identifying more of these regime actors and freezing certain assets and banks around the world. But I think there were two things that really made this difficult for the Iranians. One is the United States taking on some very, very stringent sanctions directed at the Iranian central bank, essentially saying to countries around the world that, you know, you can either do business with this bank or you can do business with the United States. You have to choose, and that's a very easy choice for a lot of companies around the world. There was also the EU taking steps on its own to prevent Iran's access to banking systems to move money around and through the European Union. So it was a combination of UN sanctions, multilateral sanctions, and different sort of unilateral, I don't think you can call the EU unilateral, but still actions outside the UN. And the combined impact of all of these things, I think, is what finally brought the Iranians to the table.
And do we have any sanctions? And I want to get into the sort of the snapback provisions of this because, you know, when I get emails about, and they're primarily, I have to say, from supporters of Israel, I guess, who think that this is the death knell of Israel, or in some fashion, and they talk about the there's no way Iran knows these sanctions can't come back. Before we get to the snapback provisions, are there still sanctions that have to do with what with other things that Iran does that we have a problem with? In other words, there's two major issues, right, or issue sets. One has been the nuclear issue, and the other is we don't like you funding certain groups, or we don't like you exercising your influence in certain regions.
Yes, I mean, there are sanctions related to the support for terrorist groups that remain on the book, both from the UN and the United States, and the EU for that matter. There's sanctions also on human rights abusers inside the Iranian government. And there's also something I just want to point out here. that, you know, the Obama administration even hasn't been, I think, loud enough in claiming credit for this. But back in 2011, when Hillary Clinton was still Secretary of State, the U.S. lobbied for very strongly and helped create a special rapporteur at the U.N. for the problem of human rights in Iran. This is something Iran lobbied against very, very aggressively. They understood that it was, you know, putting a spotlight on their human rights abuses in a way that really, really, you know, harmed them politically. So that's something that will remain. That special rapporteur is still in power. He continues to report on the dire situation of human rights in Iran. So there are ways in which the U.S. and its partners are continuing to press Iran on these other issues, even though the nuclear file is being closed.
And so let's talk about this snapback provision. It seems to me that what is happening is that the based upon how the mechanism to reinstitute these sanctions, how it's formulated, that in some ways this isn't really, the sanctions aren't ending full stop. What they are doing is they are going almost into remission in some way,
mm-hmm.
right? They're being suspended. So the default is they kick back in some fashion.
Exactly. They need to be the continuing suspension of the sanctions that is written into the new Security Council resolution needs to be continually reaffirmed by the UN Security Council. So if you have a situation in which Iran, one of the members of the P5 plus one, or the U.S. or France or someone else, is, we, you know, Iran is not allowing access to this one particular site, we have reason to believe or reason to suspect that there's something going on there. Iran says, no, there's nothing going on there. It goes to a committee that looks this over. If either party is not happy with that committee's decision, they can then go to the UN Security Council and say, all right, we're not supporting the further lifting of sanctions. I mean, this is actually a pretty clever mechanism by the U.S. and its partners to say that, okay, this is a way in which, say, Russia or China cannot veto this move. You need the whole, you know, if you're making it incumbent on everyone to agree to the lifting of sanctions, if one of the parties says, no, we don't agree, then the sanctions aren't lifted.
So I mean, just for people to understand this conceptually, there's no lift here to actually reimpose sanctions. It's almost there's somebody holding the sanctions up from
right.
snapping back into place. So
right. The onus is on Iran to continue cooperating.
And in the event that they cooperate, I mean, let's say everything goes swimmingly. What does the deal call for in terms of Iran's obligations?
Well, Iran has to open its nuclear program to the deepest and broadest inspections regime in the world, or frankly, in the history of the world. This is the key. I think something to keep in mind here is that there it will be inspections and visibility on every level of Iran's nuclear supply chain, from the moment they dig the uranium ore out of the ground to the moment they finally, you know, many steps later, transfer it into uranium hexafluoride. So there's various ways for Iran to be caught, various levels of inspections here. So in order for Iran to conceivably cheat and break out and create a nuclear weapon, they would have to avoid detection at every single stage of that supply chain.
So just so people know, there are two mines that the Iranians have where they get uranium. They get very poor quality uranium there. Mm-hmm. And there is inspections. We know what's taken out of the mines. And in fact, I believe the Americans basically set up these mines in the 70s. So it's not like we're not intimately aware of how these mines work. We know what goes into what their input is. We know what their output is. We also have a regime, an inspection regime set up in those companies or facilities that they have that could actually make centrifuges, right?
Right.
And
so,
go ahead.
Well, no, I think there has been a concern raised. Okay, we have 24/7 monitoring on Iran's known nuclear sites. Now, in the event that there was a suspicion of some activity in an undeclared site, this is where the 24-day issue has come into play. Some of your listeners may have heard one of the criticisms of this deal is that it doesn't give the IAEA access to everywhere, every square foot of Iran, anytime it wants. Now, there's no country in the world that would accept that sort of inspection regime. We just need to recognize that as a reality.
That's a basically a full throttle, you know, basically saying you're not a sovereign country anymore, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you can't, you know, we're going to go into your homes. We're going to go into your military bases. I mean, that's what I hear. It's like, how can you say that people can't go into the military bases? Well, military bases aren't set up to be facilities in which you enrich uranium. That would be, you know, you would need to actually really sort of do some work there, right?
No, exactly. That's, I mean, what I'm getting is, I mean, you talk to actual nuclear experts, you know, 24 days is when you're talking about cleansing a site from evidence of nuclear research or nuclear activity, 24 days is not a long time. I mean, you're not talking about a few guys going into hose down a room here.
Right.
You're talking about a very serious operation. Just for example, let's look at the...
This isn't Breaking Bad. Right? This
isn't actually, you're not throwing a bag of weed, you know, down the toilet or something. I mean, this is a serious operation needed to conceal these activities.
And so, I mean, so go ahead. So they get the 24 hours, the 24 days.
24 days.
Right.
Yeah.
And presumably, I mean, I would imagine we have satellites, right? Like, we would notice if there was a significant amount of activity. If we have suspicions about a location, or just general suspicions, right? I mean, of that, hey, this company has been ordering things which you would need to create centrifuges. You have 24 days to answer
right.
us as to, like, how those things are being used.
Right.
Presumably, we would have apparatus, satellites, whatever, to sort of detect a certain amount of activity that would be involved in even an attempt to sort of scrub a situation
right.
like that.
Right, and I think that in itself, the depth and breadth and intensity of this inspections regime is itself a deterrent to cheating. Now, I mean, I think let's recognize this. There's nothing about this deal that involves trusting Iran. In fact, not trusting Iran is what this entire deal is based on. But just the fact that there's so many ways for Iran to be caught, and so many things they would have to do along the way, to achieve a very, very complex outcome. That in itself is a deterrent to Iran cheating.
Do you think, and I want to get to the role of Congress in this in a minute, but and maybe this is do you think it's possible that Iran, I mean, we've heard differing statements over the years, but the Supreme Leader has been, I think, as far as I can tell, fairly consistent in saying that nuclear weapons are sort of verboten. I don't think that's the term he uses. But do you think that it's possible, likely, I don't know, that, in fact, not only did has Iran never had intentions, but they found that it could be ultimately politically helpful to them to sort of be ambiguous in certain areas about it, because this might provide something to them to give away that really is of no cost to them to begin to forge better relations internationally, because it seems to me Iran has been trying to make overtures, at least to the United States, since the early 2000s, maybe before that. But there's been plenty of stories over the years of Iranians saying, like, it will help you in Afghanistan. Iranians saying, we want to meet, I think, with Swiss, I think it was Switzerland that sent a message to us and say that we're interested in a thaw of our relations now. Is it possible that they said, like, look, we need to give them something? We don't have anything necessarily to give, or at least there's certain things that we don't want to give, which is we don't want to go away in terms of a regime. So let's, you know, be ambiguous as to whether or not we have nuclear weapon intentions, and then eventually we give that away.
I think that's possible. I mean, you only have to look next door to Iraq, and that's more or less what Saddam Hussein was trying to do, although he did it very poorly.
But, right.
You know, he wanted to create this kind of sense of ambiguity. Why? Because he feared Iran. But I think more broadly, I mean, yes, there have been moments, you mentioned Afghanistan, where the Iranian regime and different actors inside the Iranian regime have recognized that the U.S. and Iran do have some common interests. I think you've got a situation like that now with regard to Daesh and the battle against Daesh in the Middle East. But I think we really need to recognize that for many, including the Supreme Leader Khamenei himself, anti-Americanism still remains a kind of foundational part of the Iranian regime's ideology. That's not to say that there won't be moments of pragmatism, but I think Khamenei himself and his circle of close advisors still hew very, you know, strongly to, you know, what, you know, the ideas that gave rise to the Iranian Revolution, which was against U.S. regional interference and the idea that the U.S. was a you know, an interloper in the region. So I don't think, you know, I think there are certain, there's elements certainly in the Iranian government that are willing to countenance and understand it's in Iran's interest to kind of dial down the tensions with the United States. But I don't think we'll be seeing any embrace of a broader rapprochement anytime soon.
And just to be clear, you said Daesh is when you refer to that in terms of our shared interests, you're talking about ISIS.
ISIS, yeah. Daesh is the Arabic term.
Okay, and so so let's talk about going forward before we get to Congress. Well, let's talk about Congress now. There's obviously a lot of, you know, a lot of people have built their careers, it seems to me, on making Iran sound like, you know, the next coming of the Third Reich, I guess. And ranging from guys like John McCain, who tried to start a singing career, I guess, with his hit Bomb Iran back in the day. But also across the aisle, I mean, of course, you have the neocons, and then you also have, I think, I'm not even sure how I would characterize them other than maybe Likudniks, and maybe, unfortunately, that term has become less relevant as Israel has moved more Likudnik itself, but guys like Menendez or Chuck Schumer, who have in the past taken a lot of their marching orders from AIPAC or from the most conservative pro-Israel voices in this country. Give me a sense of A, what role Congress has in this first, and then whether, you know, what role they'll play. Because people should understand, this isn't a treaty, is it?
No, it's an agreement, an executive agreement. It is not. But I still think, you know, Congress does have a role to play. I think even the administration recognizes that Congress does have a role to play, even though the executive branch, the administration, has, you know, the larger part of power and influence in creating and implementing U.S. foreign policy. Congress does have an oversight role, and thus they should have an opportunity to weigh in on this deal. And I think that's what the Corker bill managed to provide. It created a process by which Congress could review and offer its view on this deal. So I think, you know, you've
but
seen
so what does that mean? What does that mean? Like, they get to offer their view on it. It's like a non-binding resolution that they can vote on?
Well, the Corker bill created a mechanism wherein if a certain number, if Congress didn't like the deal, they could vote against the administration's ability to lift certain U.S. unilateral sanctions, which would effectively prevent the United States from, you know, following out its part of the deal.
All right, so let's break this down here. So people should understand this is not a treaty because all it does, there's no real obligation on the part of the United States other than for the president to lift sanctions that he statutorily, when these sanctions were passed, he has the ability to do, right? So there's, so that's,
he yeah, can, I mean, those, yeah, these laws contain, you know, the president has the authority to lift them temporarily.
Okay. And so, and theoretically, right, the Corker bill basically says, even though this is not a even though the president has all this ability, the president wants some buy-in from us. So we have this law where we could actually rescind that statutory authority from the president. Now, of course, the president, if such a law were to pass, could theoretically veto it, couldn't he?
He could, yeah. I mean, that's why the real question comes down to, can Congress, can the conservatives in Congress cobble together a veto-approved majority? That's the real question right now.
And how does that look? I mean, this is a question really at this. It comes down to sort of how much Democratic support the president will have. Do we have a sense of what that's going to look like?
No, I think it'll pretty much. My own prediction here is that it's going to play out as in the past, as it played out with the Corker bill, as it played out with support for the Joint Plan of Action, about a year and a half ago when Congress was thinking about new sanctions that would actually violate that interim deal. At the end of the day, Democrats, I think, even though they have very serious and legitimate concerns about Iran, because Iran is a bad actor in the region, Iran says horrible and threatening things about the U.S., about Israel, about, you know, our allies, they recognize that this is an important achievement by not only in general in terms of U.S. policy, but by a Democratic president. So I think even though there's going to be a moment of, there's going to be a period of debate, and it's probably going to get pretty loud and perhaps pretty ugly. You can always count on that when we're talking about, you know, the neocons making all kinds of claims about how this is the new Munich, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, I think the administration has a very, very strong argument about why this agreement is good for the United States, why it's good for our allies. And I think we've seen consistently that Americans support diplomacy with Iran. They support dealing with this problem through diplomacy. And we just saw a poll today by the ABC Washington Post that has a majority of Americans who support this deal.
And I would imagine this isn't just a question. I mean, I think I saw this written up as, you know, this is going to be a big test of Democrats' loyalty to Barack Obama. But I imagine this is really just this is not just simply about Barack Obama. This is also about Hillary Clinton or any other likely Democratic president coming in 2016, because they don't want this to be an open question either, I would imagine.
Right.
And everything I've read from even, I think, people who are sort of marginal critics of this process seems to be a near unanimity that this is going to prevent, if you start with the premise that Iran had intentions to have a nuclear weapon in the first place, which I think is still even dubious, but let's just presume for the sake of argument that that this is going to prevent them from getting back onto that track by 15 years, and then you're still adding another 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, I guess, to get to where they would be today. And so we're talking about 20, 25 years, if you believe that that was what Iran's intentions were. And so this puts it off the table for a lot of people in the future, too, doesn't it?
I think it does. But I think one of the biggest assets that the deal, you know, the side supporting the deal, people such as myself have, is that the critics of the deal have yet to offer any plausible alternative. You know, if you go back to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech in Congress back in March, his argument was, this is a bad deal, you can get a better deal. Well, what's a better deal? I mean, that's basically as far as the argument goes. It says, well, let's just pressure Iran more, and they'll give us more of what we want. There's no plausible strategy for achieving that. So I think in the absence of any plausible alternative, that's part of what has strengthened the case for this deal.
And so just to be clear, like, you know, it's not that we want like free rugs, free Persian rugs for the rest of, you know, for the next 20 years. The point is that the only thing that they want more is really just regime change. Right. I mean, that's what is sort of it seems to me. And you tell me your assessment. The unstated, I guess, proposition here is that we want regime change. So if we were to maintain these sanctions, the Iranian regime would fall. It would be Iran would become suddenly a democratic country with a more pro-Western, pro-Israel leadership, and all of our problems would go away. I mean, that's really the unspoken proposition, isn't it? And
well, it's often spoken, you know. But I mean, I think it comes down to the question of what tools you want to use to achieve that. I mean, just to put my cards on the table here, as a progressive and a supporter of human rights, gender equality and all these things. I mean, I want to see the regime in Iran change. I want this, and you know, this authoritarian regime to evolve and eventually go away. I personally want to see a more democratic, more humanitarian, more humanistic and liberal Iran. But the question is, what tools does the United States have to actually achieve that outcome? And how should we prioritize that? My view, and I think this is the administration's view, they've made it repeatedly, is that, you know, the priority here, and this is a priority that our allies in the region, particularly Netanyahu, have set, is that we had to deal with the nuclear program. Now, in the absence of this deal, I see Iran evolving in a much more authoritarian direction much more quickly. With this deal, with, you know, a more moderate leadership under Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif having now been empowered by delivering sanctions relief to Iran, I at least see the possibility of Iran evolving in a more liberal direction.
What would have been the likelihood? Let's say that the United States said, like, okay, we're going to get a better deal, but we don't know what that better deal is, right? I mean, honestly, like, there's no regime in the world. You can't have, on one hand, a despotic regime, or really even a democratic regime, that is going to say, like, okay, we're going to allow you, other country, or the world, to come in and basically look wherever you want for whatever you want. That's just not going to happen. Yeah. At one point, the sanctions fall apart, right? I mean, we can have the U.S. sanctions, but the rest of the world is going to get into the business. Yeah. Right? I mean,
no, I think that's right, and that's something that I think Americans need to understand, that we haven't done business with Iran since the revolution. So that's 35 years of very, very little contact, no real trade relationship to speak of. It's been very different for Europe. They've been doing business with Iran all along. So it's one thing for the United States to have, you know, to block trade and have sanctions on economic activity with Iran. It doesn't really bite us as much. For the Europeans, it's very, very different. There are much higher political costs within Europe for sanctioning, you know, different businesses and sanctioning economic activity with Iran. So for the United States, with all of these businesses now pressuring their own government, saying, okay, we'd like to go back to our business relationships, it'd be a great way for the United States to tee off our allies by saying, you know, after all of that, we're just going to walk away from this deal now. It would be untenable.
How much of this is an indication that we have moved somewhat in terms of our the perception in our foreign policy establishment of the importance of our relationship with Saudi Arabia? Because it seems to me that it doesn't seem to me. I mean, I think it's widely accepted that we are basically many times watching a proxy war between proxies for Saudi Arabia and Iran fighting each other on a sort of a Shia-Sunni divide. And I would imagine the Saudis are not excited at the prospect of Iran not being so radioactive, no pun intended, and Iran also having the resources to fight that proxy war more efficiently or strongly.
Yeah, no, I think that the way you laid it out there is just a really important point. For Israel, I think the issue is the nuclear, the possibility of an Iranian nuclear weapon. It's also their support for terrorist groups on Israel's border. But it's also partly, you know, an unconstrained or a less constrained Iran. For the Saudis, it's much more the latter. I mean, the Saudis and their Gulf allies are very, very comfortable, or have become very, very comfortable with a situation in which Iran is basically treated as a pariah, and they are, you know, they're the good BFFs of the United States, even though in reality these countries are less democratic than Iran and just as abusive of their own populations as Iran. But once you close the nuclear file, then Iran starts to look a lot like these other countries, even though it continues to be hostile to the United States. But just in terms of its own bad behavior, it's an authoritarian country that exports radicalism, just like a lot of these Gulf countries.
How much of, like, when you see U.S. backing of what Saudi Arabia has been doing in Yemen, how much of that is us farming out part of our foreign policy agenda, and how much of it is us saying, like, all right, look, we understand that we've ruffled your feathers because we've made Iran less of a pariah. So we'll give you this one.
Well, I think it's probably more the former. I mean, the U.S., I mean, let's, you know, that Saudi Arabia actually had to use military force in Yemen is, of course, a huge failure of Saudi Arabian foreign policy. I mean, the fact that that all of this seemed to have taken Saudi Arabia by surprise, I mean, just shows how anemic and ineffective its policy process and its intelligence are, you know, in even understanding what's going on in its own neighborhood. Mm. At the same time, I do think it's reflective of, you know, the Obama administration has, you know, for many past administrations have said things about partners in the Middle East taking more responsibility for their own security. But it's always, you know, the U.S. seems to be coming in and helping people solve their problems for them. I think Obama has recognized that, you know, we just can't keep doing this. It's both politically and economically unsustainable for the United States to continue to play sheriff in the Middle East as we have. And that involves trying to facilitate some of these other countries dealing with the problems for themselves. Now, that's going to be a very ugly process. It's already been ugly, as we've seen. But I think as part of a shift in the way the U.S. conceptualizes problem solving in the region, I think it's necessary.
Matt, finally, and this may be out of your portfolio, but in the event that we ultimately sign this agreement with Iran, I don't know what the timetable would be. Are we talking like 2 months, 3 months, 6 months? Do you have a sense of that?
When we finally, I'm sorry.
With what has to happen in Congress, when will we be at the point where we actually sign this agreement or implement
it? Well, the agreement is essentially, I mean, there was a UN Security Council resolution today unanimously accepting the agreement. So as far as, you know, the UN and the P5+1 and the parties that negotiated this agreement, it's essentially done at the international level. So Congress can decide if they want to muck things up. They will have that option.
So wait, so how does this work, like, mechanically? So tomorrow, does the president say, look, we're going to start to lend. We're going to unfreeze your assets. I've told OFAC. All the U.S. Sanctions and all of those mechanisms have now been basically suspended. Does that happen tomorrow?
Well, I think it's always the case that the U.S. sanctions, the U.S. unilateral sanctions, would be the last ones to come off.
Okay.
And let's recognize it's not as if the U.N. has lifted their sanctions. What they did was produce a new U.N. Security Council resolution that rescinded past resolutions on sanctions and essentially laid out a new timeline for the lifting of sanctions, as we spoke about earlier.
Okay. And so when will this issue be over in terms of Congress? I mean, will this play out over the next 2 months?
Yes.
1 month?
Yeah, Congress has 60 days to review.
Okay. And so we will know, I guess, within 65 days as to where we stand. Your prediction is that one way or another, the end result is going to be that we're going forward with this. This is a done deal.
I think the debate could get ugly, but I think at the end of the day, this is going to be supported by the Democrats because it's, for many reasons, one of which is that it's supported by Americans.
Well, I guess the only question after that is that what's going to happen to Sunday morning talk shows? Like what with John McCain? What will Lindsey Graham and John McCain talk about?
But that's the beauty of being John McCain and Lindsey Graham is there's always some other country to bomb.
Right.
You know?
There you go.
So they'll just move on.
All right. Well, Matt Duss, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, thank you so much for...
always happy to do it. Thanks, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We're going to head into our fun half of the program. Want to say a couple words to people who watch the show on YouTube. We'll be back. Matt is back. It'll be just probably a number of weeks before little Ezra is cutting up YouTubes. We're not afraid to exploit baby labor here. Should put him on, maybe.
Yeah. And before you poo-poo baby labor, when you open up your Indiegogo DVD or package or whatever you got perk-wise. Just know that child labor is what got you that package.
Mila did a little stuffing for like $10. Like, I bought her new duct tape supplies. It was basically it.
What did it roughly work out to? 7 cents an hour?
Not even. Not even. She's still working now. She missed a lot of school.
Luckily, it's summer.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, folks, obviously now that Matt is a parent, this is going to be a worry for him, but Alex Jones will explain to Matt how the UN is going to eradicate humanity by turning kids gay. Of course, it's a devious plan. Fascinating plan. Also,
I'll have to load up my son on some of that. What was that, the male vitality?
Yeah, exactly. I want to make it clear right now. We're going to be talking about Donald Trump in the fun half of the program. And I'm going to have some pretty barbed things to say about John McCain.
That's right.
I still remember, folks. I am so old that I remember when John McCain chose Sarah Palin. You remember her, that other failed reality TV star. In fact, Trump had more success than she did as a reality star. Yes, that's true. But I also remember John McCain's campaign in 2004. Or I should say the Republican campaign in 2004. You know, all the RNC talking about what you don't say about veterans, all of that. I think there is an attempt here by the Republican establishment, well, obviously, to get rid of Donald Trump, but to keep him from the debates. It'll be interesting to see if they go this far. But it is just hilarious to watch them scurry about. And this is their last refuge, folks. Remember this. When they start to exploit veterans, this is their last refuge. If they can't find out that Donald Trump is a secret Muslim, this is it. They should have started on the birth certificate a long time ago with Donald Trump. But sadly, they embraced him. Mitt Romney embraced him. John McCain, they all embraced him. Now it's just revealed that he came out and he said something mean about John McCain. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? I can't wait until the next poll comes out and they realize that Donald Trump is correct. John McCain's a loser and the Republicans don't like him. I am prepared in the fun half of the program today to make my endorsement for the Republican primaries. A lot of people said you are showing your bias by endorsing Bernie Sanders. And did I give an official endorsement of Bernie Sanders?
I think it was official.
I just said that I'm going to vote for him. Well, obviously I am not eligible to vote in the Republican primary. But when we come back in the fun half of the program, to be fair, I'm going to make an endorsement within the Republican primary. Because otherwise I would be biased or unbalanced. And so I'm going to make my endorsement in the fun half of the program. I keep you in suspense. Who I would recommend Republican voters vote for. So,
no one could anticipate this.
No. And we'll talk about, and I want to hear your calls and IMs. I'm just turning on the IM now. I'm a little bit rusty. About what took place at Netroots Nation this past weekend. The big talk, of course, is that a presidential forum with only two of the candidates, right? It was only O'Malley and Bernie Sanders. Were there. Jim Webb wasn't there, as far as I know, right?
No, I don't think Webb or Chafee were there.
And neither was Hillary Clinton.
Was obviously Hillary, yeah. Kind of surprising in some ways, given all the efforts that she's been making to sort of.
Oh, no, I'm not surprised that she didn't go. I was surprised that Webb wasn't there.
Right. Probably too many black people around for him. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have made that joke. Sorry. That was mean.
Michael.
And unfair. I apologize.
Michael, I'm going to chastise you because I know supporters of Jim Webb don't appreciate that type of joking around. So you're officially repudiated and chastised. And if it's necessary, if I get even one tweet about it, you're going to be docked.
And
maybe
I apologize
for 6 months' pay.
Better than nothing.
Okay, it's better. and you'll get 6 months of pay for the year, which is, of course, I don't know how many times better than nothing. I mean, it's a lot of times better than nothing. Also, yes, I will talk about the episode of Mark Maron's program that I was on that ran while I was gone. I haven't seen it. I saw part of it. All right. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me using the app. It's a free app. You pick it up at majorityapp.com. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. There's free shipping. Do it. Very helpful to the program. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. And the best way to support the program, of course, is to become a member. We are supported by members. By 99% of our revenue comes from members. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Maybe we should put a new membership level. Binder's Baby.
Binder's Baby?
Yeah.
There's not even a Sam's Baby level.
No.
Where's Saul and Milo?
Forget it. All right, we'll be right back after this.